Chapter 13. Shygek. Men are forever pointing at others, which is why I always follow the knuckle and not the nail. Antillus, On the Folly of Men. A day with no noon, a year with no fall, love is forever new, or love is not at all. Anonymous, Ode to the Loss of Losses. Late Summer, 4111, Year of the Tusk, Shygek. There was light. Esme. She stirred. What was her dream? Yes, swimming. The pool in the hills above the battle plain. A hand grasped her bare shoulder. A gentle squeeze. Esme, you must wake up. But she was so warm. She blinked, grimaced when she realized it was still night. Lamplight. Someone carried a lamp. What was Akka doing? She rolled onto her back, saw Kellis kneeling over her, his expression grave. Frowning, she pulled her blanket over her breasts. What? She started, but paused to clear her throat. What is it? The library of the Sariots, he said in a hollow voice. It burns. She could only blink at the lamplight. The Scarlet Spires have destroyed it, Esme. She turned, looking for a Kamian. Something about Zynemus's expression struck Proyas to the marrow. He looked away, ran an idle thumb over the lip of his golden wine bowl, which lay empty on the table before him. He stared at the glister of the eagle stamped into its side. And just what would you have me do, Zin? Incredulity and impatience. Everything in your power! The marshal had informed him of a Kamian's abduction 2 days previous. Never had Proyas seen him so frantic with worry. At his behest, he'd issued orders for the arrest of Thereshut, a baron from the southern marches he only vaguely remembered. Then he'd ridden to Iothea, where he demanded and received an audience with Eleazarus himself. The Grand Master had been accommodating, but he categorically denied the marshal's accusations. He claimed his people had stumbled upon a hidden cell of Kishorim while investigating the Sariotic library. We grieve the loss of two of our own, he said solemnly. When Proyas asked, with all due courtesy, to view the Kishorim remains, Eleazarus said, You can take them if you wish. Have you a sack? You do see, his eyes had said, the futility of what you do. But Proyas had seen the futility from the very beginning. Even if they could find Thereshut. Soon the Holy War would cross the River Sempis and assault Scordus on the south bank. The men of the Tusk needed the Scarlet Spires, desperately if what the Skilvendi said was true. What was the life of one man? A blasphemer, no less, compared with that need. The god demanded sacrifices. Proyas could see the futility. He could scarce see anything else. The difficulty was one of making Zynemus see. Everything in my power, the prince repeated. And what, pray tell, might that be, Zin? What power does a prince of Conria hold over the Scarlet Spires? He regretted the impatience in his tone, but it couldn't be helped. Zynemus continued to stand at the ready, as though on parade.
You could call a council.
Yes, I could, but what purpose would that serve?
Purpose?
Zynemus repeated, obviously horrified.
What purpose would it serve?
Yes. It may be a hard question, but it's honest.
Don't you understand? Zynemus exclaimed. A Kamian isn't dead and gone. I'm not asking you to avenge him. They've taken him, Proyas. Even now, somewhere in Iothea, they hold him. They ply him in ways you and I cannot imagine. The Scarlet Spires have a Kamian.
The Scarlet Spires. For those who lived in the High Aenon Shadow, they were the very name of dread. Proyas breathed deep. The god had decreed his priorities. Faith makes strong. Zin, I know how this torments you. I know you feel responsible, but...
You ungrateful, arrogant little pissant!
The marshal exploded. He seized the corners of the table, leaned forward over the sheaves of parchment. Spittle flecked his beard.
Did you learn so little from him, or was your heart flint in childhood as well? This is a Kamian, Proyas, Akka! The man who doted on you, who cherished you, the man who made you into who you are. Remember yourself, Marshal. I will You will hear me out!
Zynemus roared, pounding the table with his fist. The golden wine bowl bounced and rolled off the edge.
As inflexible as you are, the Marshal grated, you know how these things work. Remember what you said on the Endymion Heights. The game is without beginning or end. I'm not asking you to storm Eliazarus's compound, Proyas. I'm simply asking you to play the game. Make them think you'll stop at nothing to see Arkas safe, that you're willing to declare open war against them if he should be killed. If they believe you're willing to forsake anything, even Holy Shima, to recover Akamian, they will yield. They will yield.
Proyas stood, retreated from his old sword trainer's furious aspect. He did know how these things worked. He had threatened Eliazarus with war. He laughed bitterly.
Are you mad, Zin? Are you truly asking me to put my old boyhood tutor before my god? To put a sorcerer before my god?
Zynemus released the table, stood upright.
After all these years, you still don't understand, do you?
What's there to understand? Proyas cried. How many times must we have this conversation? Akamian is unclean. Unclean!
A heady sense of conviction seized him, an incontestable making certain, as though knowing possessed its own fury.
If blasphemers kill blasphemers, then we're saved oil and wood!
Zynemus flinched as though struck.
So, you will do nothing.
And neither will you, Marshal. We prepare to march against the south bank. The Padiraja has summoned every Sapatishah from Girgash to Umana. All Kian assembled.
Then I resign as Marshal of Atrempas,
Zynemus declared in a stiff voice.
What is more, I repudiate you, your father, and my oath to House Nersay. No longer shall I call myself a knight of Conraya.
Proyas felt a numbness through his face and hands. This was impossible.
Think about this, Zin.
He said breathlessly,
everything, your estates, your chattel, the sanctions of your caste, everything you have, everything you are, will be forfeit.
No, Prosha, he said, turning for the curtains. It's you who surrender everything.
Then he was gone. The reed wick of his oil lamp sputtered and fizzled. The gloom deepened.
So much. The endless battles with his peers, the heathen, the burdens, the innumerable burdens, the never-ending fear of what might come. And Zynemus had always been there. He'd always been the one who understood, who made clear what vexed, who shouldered what was beyond bearing.
Akka, sweet Seja, what had he done? Nirsay Proyas fell to his knees, clutched at a knifing pang in his stomach. But the tears wouldn't come.
I know you test me. I know you test me.
Two bodies, one warmth. Wasn't that what Kellis had said of love? Esmanet watched Zynemus sit hesitantly, as though unsure of his welcome. He ran a heavy hand across his face. She could see the desperation in his eyes.
I've made, he said leadenly, what inquiries I could.
He meant there had been talk, the chatter of men who must make certain sounds, preserve certain semblances.
No, you must make more. You can't give up, Zin, not after—
The pain in his eyes completed her sentence.
The Holy War assaults the South Bank in a matter of days, Esme.
He pursed his lips. He meant the issue of Drusus Akamian had been conveniently forgotten, as all intractable and embarrassing matters must be. How? How could one know Drusus Akamian, wander through his precincts, and then pull away, whisked like sheets across dry skin? But they were men. Men were dry on the outside, and wet only within. They couldn't co-mingle, weld their life to another in the ambiguity of fluids, not truly.
Perhaps,
she said, wiping tears and trying hard, very hard, to smile.
Perhaps Proyas is lonely. Perhaps he needs to take his ease with—
No, Esme, no.
Hot tears. She shook her head slowly, her face slack.
No, I must do something. There must be something I can do.
Zynemis looked past her to the sunny earth, as though searching for lost words.
Why won't you stay with Kellis and Serwe?
He asked. So much had changed in such a short time. Zynemis's camp had dissolved with his station. Kellis had taken Serwe to join Proyas, something that had dismayed her, even though she understood his reasons. As much as Kellis loved Akka, all men were his province now.
But how she'd begged, groveled. She had even tried, at the pitch of shameful desperation, to seduce him, though he would have none of it. The Holy War. The Holy War. Everything was about the fucking Holy War. What about a Commian?
But Kellis couldn't cross fate. He had a far greater whore to answer to.
And if Akka comes back? She sobbed. What if he comes back and can't find me?
Though everyone had left, her tent, Akka's tent, hadn't moved. She lingered in the gap where her joy had been. Now, under the command of Erisus, the Atrempans treated her with deference and respect. The sorcerer's woman, they called her.
It's not good for you to stay here alone, Zynemis said. Erisus will march with Proyas soon, and the Shigeki. There could be reprisals.
I'll manage, she croaked. I've spent my life alone, Zin.
Zynemis pressed himself to his feet. He held a hand to her cheek, pinched away a tear with a gentle thumb.
Stay safe, Esme.
What are you going to do?
He glanced into the distance behind her, perhaps at the hazy ziggurats, perhaps at nothing.
Search,
he said in a hopeless voice.
I'll ride with you, she exclaimed, jumping to her feet. I'm coming, Akka, I'm coming.
Zynemis strode wordlessly to his horse, climbed into his saddle. He drew a knife from his girdle, then tossed it high in the air. It thudded into the bare earth between her feet.
Take it, he said. Be safe, Esme.
For the first time, Esmenet noticed Dinchazes and Zenkappa in the distance, also mounted, waiting for their former lord. They waved before falling in behind him. She fell to her seat, burst into further sobs. She buried her face in hot arms. When she looked up, they were gone. Helplessness. If women were Hope's oldest companions, it was due to helplessness. Certainly women often exercised dreadful power over a single hearth, but the world between hearths belonged to men, and it was into this world that a Commian had disappeared, the cold darkness between fire pits. All she could do was wait. What greater anguish could there be than waiting? Nothing etched the shape of one's impotence with more galling meticulousness than the blank passage of time. Moment after moment, some dull with disbelief, others taut with voiceless shrieks. Moment after gnashing moment, bright with a flare of agonized questions. Where is he? What will I do without him? Dark with the exhaustion of hope.
He's dead. I am alone.
Waiting. This was what tradition said a woman should do, to wait at the hearth's edge, to peer and yet always be stared down, to haggle endlessly with nothing, to think without hope of insight, to repeat words said and words implied, to chase hints into incantations, as though by their tumbling precision and the sheer pitch of their pain, the movements of her soul might seize the world at some deeper level and force it to yield. As the days passed, it seemed she'd become a still point in the ponderous wheel of events, the only structure to remain after the flood waters retreated. The tents and pavilions fell like shrouds unfurled across the dead. The vast baggage trains were loaded. Armored men on horse chopped to and fro from the horizon, bearing arcane missives, onerous commands. Great columns were formed up across the pasture, and with shouts and hymns, they passed away. Like a season. And Esmenet sat alone in the midst of their absence. She watched the breeze tease threads free of trampled grasses. She watched bees dart like black buzzing dots across the bruised reaches. She felt embalmed by the silence. She was held motionless by the false peace of passing commotion.
sitting before a commune's tent, her back turned to their pathetic possessions, her every surface exposed to gaping, sun-bright spaces, she wept, called out his name as though he might lie hidden behind some copse of black willows, whose verdant branches waved each independent of the other, as though beneath the tug of different skies. She could almost see him, crouched behind that shade-black trunk. "Come out, Akka. They've all left. It's safe now, my love." Day, night. Esmonette would make her own silent inquiries, an interrogation without hope of answer. She would think much of her dead daughter, and make forbidden comparisons between that cold world and this one. She would walk down to the Sempis and stare at its black waters, not knowing whether she wanted to drink or drown. She would glimpse herself in the distance, arms waving. One body, no warmth. Day, night, moment by moment. Esmonette had been a whore, and whores knew how to wait. Patience through the long succession of lusts, her days lined up as though words on a scroll as long as life, each whispering the same thing. "It's safe now, my love. Come out." It is safe. Since leaving Zynemus's camp, Naor passed his days much as before, either conferring with Proyas or discharging his requests. Scaurus had wasted little time in the weeks following his defeat on the battle plain. He'd ceded what land he couldn't hold, which included the entire north bank of the Sempis. He burned every boat he could find to prevent any mass crossing, raised makeshift watchtowers along the entire south bank, and gathered the remnants of his army. Fortunately for the Shigeki and their new Enrithi warlords, he hadn't burned the granaries or scorched the fields and orchards as he withdrew. In council, Sauban claimed this was due to the heathens' haste, which in turn was due to their terror. But Naor knew better. There had been nothing haphazard about the Kianin evacuation of the north bank. They knew Hinnereth would delay the men of the Tusk. Even at Zerkerta, where the Skilvendi had crushed the heathen 8 years before, the Kianin had recovered quickly from their initial rout. They were a tenacious and resourceful race. Scaurus had spared the north bank, Naor knew, because he intended to reclaim it. This wasn't a fact in Reethi's stomachs found easy to digest. Even Proyas, who'd set aside the many conceits of his caste and had embraced Naor's tutelage, couldn't believe the Kianin still posed any real threat.
"Are you assured of your victory?"
Naor asked one night while supping with a prince in private.
"Assured," Proyas replied. "But of course."
"Why?"
"Because my god has willed it."
"And Scaurus, would he not give much the same answer?"
Proyas's eyebrows jumped up, then knitted into a frown.
"But that's not the point, Skilvendi. How many thousands have we killed? How much terror have we struck into their hearts?"
"Too few thousands, and far, far too little terror."
Naor explained the way the memorialists recited verses dedicated to each of the Nansur columns, stories that described their devices, their arms, and their mettle in battle, so that when the tribes went on pilgrimage or to war, they could read the Nansur battle line.
"This was why the people lost at Gayuth," he said. "Gonfis switched his column's devices, told us a false story."
"Any fool knows how to read his opponent's line," Proyas spat.
Naor shrugged.
"Then tell me," he said. "What story did you read on the battle plain?"
Proyas blanched.
"How in the blazes am I supposed to know? I recognized only a handful."
"I recognized all of them," Naor asserted. "Of all the great Kianin houses, and there are many, only 2/3 rode against us on the plains of Mangeda. Of those, several were likely token contingents, depending on how many enemies Scaurus entertains among his peers. After the massacre of the Volga Holy War, many among the heathen, including the Padiraja, were no doubt contemptuous of the Holy War's threat."
"But now?" Proyas said.
"They will not repeat their mistake. They will strike treaties with Girgash and Nilnamesh. They will empty every barracks, saddle every horse, arm every son. Make no mistake. Even now they ride toward Shigek in their thousands. They will answer Holy War with jihad."
Following this exchange, Proyas out and out capitulated to his admonishments. At the next council, after the other great names, with the exception of Confis, scoffed at Nayor and his warnings, Proyas had captives secured in cross-river raids dragged before them. They confirmed everything Nayor had predicted. For over a week, the wretches said, grandees from as far away as Seleucara and Nensiphon had been riding out of the southern deserts. Some names even the Norserai seemed to recognize. Kinganjohoy, the far-famed Sapata Shah of Umarna, Imbeyan, the Sapata Shah of Anathpania, even Dunjoksha, the tyrannical Sapata Shah who ruled the governorate of Amotu from Shima. It was agreed. The holy war had to cross the river Sempis as soon as humanly possible. To think, Proyas confided to him afterward, that I thought you no more than an effective ruse to employ against the Emperor. Now you're our general in all but name, you realize that.
I have said or offered nothing that Confis himself could not say or offer.
Proyas laughed. Save trust, Skilvendi. Save trust. Though Nayor grinned, these words cut him for some reason. What did it matter, the trust of dogs and cattle? Nayor had been born for war, as much as he'd been bred for it. This and this alone was the one certainty of his life. So he bent himself to the problem of assaulting the south bank with relish and uncommon zeal. While the great names directed the construction of rafts and barges in great enough numbers to convey the entire holy war across the Sempis, Nayor supervised the Conryan effort to find the ideal place to land. He led his war parties on night raids against the south bank, even bringing cartographers to map the terrain. If one thing impressed him about the Enrithi manner of making war, it was their use of maps. He directed the questioning of captives, and even taught several traditional Skilvendi techniques to Proyas' interrogators. He questioned those, such as Earl Athgieri, who raided the south bank to plunder and harry, about what they'd seen, and he held counsel with others, like Earl Kerjula, General Biaxi Sampas, and Palatine Urenyanka, who shared his task. Except for Proyas' counsels, he neither saw nor spoke to Kellis. The Dunyane was little more than a rumor. Nayor's days were much the same as before, but his nights, they were far different. He never pitched his tent on the same ground. Most evenings, after sunset or after supping with Proyas and his caste nobles, he rode from the Conryan camp, past the sentries and out into the fields. He struck his own fire, listened to the night wind roar through the trees. Sometimes, when he could see it, he stared at the Conryan encampment and counted fires like an idiot child.
Always number your foemen, his father had once told him, by the glitter of their fires.
Sometimes he gazed at the stars and wondered if they, too, were his enemies. Every so often he imagined he camped across the lonely steppe, the holy steppe. He often brooded over Serwe and Kellis. He found himself continually rehearsing his reasons for abandoning her to the Dunyane. He was a warrior, a Skilvendi warrior. What need had he, man-killing Nayor, of a woman? But no matter how obvious his reasons, he still couldn't help but think of her. The globes of her breasts, the wandering line of her hips, so perfect. How he'd burned for her, burned the way a warrior, a man, should. She was his prize, his proof. He remembered pretending to sleep while listening to her sob in the darkness. He remembered the remorse, as heavy as spring snow, pressing him breathless with its cold. What a fool he'd been. He thought of the apologies, of the desperate pleas that might soften her hatred, that might let her see. He thought of kissing the gentle swell of her belly. And he thought of Anissi, the first wife of his heart, slumbering in the flickering gloom of their faraway hearth, holding tight their daughter, Xanathi, as though sheltering her from the terror of womanhood. And he thought of Proyas. On the worst nights, he hugged himself in the blackness of his tent, screaming and sobbing. He beat the earth with his fists, stabbed holes with his knife, then fucked them. He cursed the world. He cursed the heavens. He cursed Anasarimber Moengus and his monstrous son. He thought, so be it. On the best nights, he made no camp at all, but instead rode to the nearest Chageki village, where he would kick in doors and glory in screams. On a whim, he avoided those doors marked with what he imagined was lamb's blood. But when he found all the doors so marked, he ceased to discriminate.
"Murder me!"
he would roar at them.
"Murder me, and it stops!"
Bawling men, shrieking girls, and silent women. He would take what compensation he could. A week passed before Nayur found the Holy War's best point of purchase on the south bank, the shallow tidal marshes along the southern edge of the Sempis Delta. Of course, all the great names, with the exception of Proyas and Confis, balked at the news, especially after their own people returned with descriptions of the terrain. They were knights, through and through, trained and bred to the charge, and, from all accounts, no horse could do more than thrash its way forward through the marsh. But of course, that was the point. At a council held in Iothea, Proyas bid him to explain his plan to the assembled Inrithi. He unrolled a large map of the southern delta across the table, occupied by the great names.
"At Mangeda," he declared, "you learned the Kianin were faster. This means no matter where you assemble to cross the Sempis, Scorus will assemble first. But at Mangeda, you also learned the strength of your footmen, and more important, you taught. These marshes are shallow. A man, even a heavily armed man, can easily walk through them, but horses must be led. As much as you pride your mounts, the Kianin pride theirs more. They will refuse to dismount, and they will not send their conscripts to contest you. What could conscripts do against men who can break a grandee's charge? No. Scorus will yield the entirety of the marsh."
He jabbed a chapped finger at the map, some distance to the south of the marsh.
"He will draw back here, to the fortress of Anwarat. He will give you all this pasture to assemble. He will cede you both ground and your horses." "How can you be so certain?"
Gothjalk cried. Of all the great names, the old Earl of Agansinor seemed the most troubled by Nayur's savage heritage, with the exception of Confis, of course.
"Because Scorus," Nayur said evenly, "is not a fool."
Gothjalk hammered a fist down on the table, but before Proyas could intervene, the Exalt General stood from his seat and said,
"He's right."
Stunned, the great names turned to him. Since the debacle at Hinnereth, Confis had largely kept his counsel. His was no longer a welcome voice, but to hear him confirm the Skilvendi on something as daring as this.
"The dog's right, as much as it pains me to say it."
He looked at Nayur with eyes that both laughed and hated.
"He's found our purchase on the south bank."
Nayur imagined cutting his pampered throat. After this, the Skilvendi chieftain's reputation was secured. He even became something of a fashion among certain Inrithi caste nobility, particularly the Einanni and their wives. Proyas had warned him this might happen.
"They will be drawn to you," he explained, "the way old leches are drawn to young boys."
Nayur found himself beset with invitations and propositions. One woman, through sheer perseverance, even found him at his camp. He stopped short of strangling her. As the far-flung Holy War began gathering near Iothea, Nayur troubled himself with thoughts of Scorus, much the way he'd once troubled himself with thoughts of Confis before the Battle of Caiuth. The man was obviously fearless. The story of him, standing alone, paring his nails while Sauban's Agmunderman archers feathered the surrounding turf, had become something of a legend. And from his interrogations of Kianin captives, Nayur had learned other details. That he was a severe disciplinarian, that he possessed a gift for organization, and that he commanded the respect of even those who otherwise outranked him, such as the Padiraja's son, Fanail, or his famed son-in-law, Imbayan. Nayur had also, quite inadvertently, learned much from Confis, who occasionally recollected incidents from his youth as a hostage of the Sipadashah. If his stories could be believed, Scorus was an exceedingly canny and strangely mischievous man. Of all these characteristics, it was this latter, mischievousness, that struck Nayur the most. Apparently, Scaurus liked to drug his unwitting guests' wine with a variety of Ainani and Nilnameshi narcotics, even with Canv on occasion. "All those who drink with me," Confis once quoted him as claiming, "drink with themselves as well." When Nayor had first heard this story, he'd thought it simply more proof of the way luxury drowned manly sense, but now he wasn't so sure. The point of the narcotics, Nayor realized, was to make his guests other to themselves, strangers with whom they could tip bowls. Which meant the wily Sapatisha not only liked to trick and deceive, he liked to show, to prove. For Scaurus, the imminent battle would be more than a contest, it would be a demonstration. The man had underestimated the Enrithi at Mangetta, seeing only his strengths and his opponent's weaknesses, much as Zunarit had underestimated Confis at Kaiuth. He wouldn't try to overpower the men of the Tusk. He was not a man to repeat his mistakes. Rather, he would try to outwit them, to show them fools. So what would the wily old warrior do? Nayor shared his apprehensions with Proyas.
"You must be sure," he told the prince, "that the Scarlet Spires remains with the host at all points."
Proyas had pressed a hand to his forehead.
"Eleazarus will resist," he said wearily. "He's already said he will follow only after the Holy War has crossed. Apparently his spies have told him the Kishorim remain in Shima." Nayor scowled and spat.
"Then we have the advantage."
"The Scarlet Spires, I fear, conserve themselves for the Kishorim."
"They must accompany us," Nayor insisted, "even if they remain hidden. There must be something you can offer."
The prince smiled mirthlessly. "Or someone," he said with uncommon grief. At least once daily, Nayor rode to the river to view the preparations. The floodplain surrounding Iothea had been denuded of trees, as had the banks of the Sempis, where thousands of barebacked Enrithi toiled over felled trunks, hacking, pounding, binding. He could ride for miles, breathing deep the smell of sweat, pitch, and hewn wood, before glimpsing the end of them. Hundreds hailed him as he passed, saluting him with cries of, "Skilvendi!" as though his ancestry had become his fame and title. Nayor need only peer across the Sempis to know that Scaurus awaited them on the far bank. As tiny as mites in the distance, Fainim horsemen continuously patrolled the shoreline, entire divisions of them. Sometimes he heard their thousand-throated jeers across the water, sometimes the throb of their drums. As a precaution, squadrons of Imperial war galleys were stationed in the river. The Holy War began embarking long before dawn. Hundreds of crude barges and thousands of rafts were first poled, then paddled into the Sempis. By the time the morning sun enameled the waters, much of the vast flotilla was underway, packed with anxious men and horses. Nayor crossed with Proyas and his immediate entourage. Zynemus was absent, which Nayor thought strange, until he realized that the marshal had his own men to watch over. But, of course, Kellis was in attendance, and the prince stood at his side for some time. They traded avid words, and periodically Proyas laughed with an uneasiness that tickled to hear. Nayor had watched the Dunyane's influence grow. He'd watched as he gradually bridled all those about Zynemus's fire, working their hearts the way saddlemakers worked leather, tanning, gouging, shaping. He'd watched as he lured more and more men of the Tusk with a grain of his deceit. He'd watched him yoke thousands, thousands, with simple words and bottomless looks. He'd watched him minister to Serwe. He'd watched until he could bear watching no more. Nayor had always known Kellis's capabilities, had always known the Holy War would yield to him. But knowing and witnessing were two different things. He cared nothing for the Enrithi, and yet, watching Kellis's lies spread like cancer across an old woman's skin, he found himself fearing for them, fearing even as he scorned them. How they fell over themselves, fawning, wheedling, groveling. How they degraded themselves, youthful fools and inveterate warriors alike, imploring looks and beseeching expressions. "Oh, Kellis, oh, Kellis!" Staggering drunks, unmanly ingrates, how easily they surrendered. And none more so than Serwe. to watch her succumb again and again, to see his hand drift deep between Dunyane thighs. I am going to provide you with an alternate because I don't think that's right. I think it's her hand. To see her hand drift deep between Dunyane thighs. Fickle, treacherous, whorish bitch. How many times must he strike her? How many times must he take her? How many times must he stare, dumbfounded by her beauty? Nayor sat cross-legged on the prow, watching the far embankment, probing the shadows beneath the trees. He could see clots of horsemen, what seemed thousands of them, tracking their slow drift downriver. The air was dank. Nervous voices rang across the waters. Inrithi calling to each other between crafts, jokes mostly. Nayor saw far too many bare asses.
"Look at the assholes!"
some wit cried out, watching the Kianin crowding the opposite bank.
"I resent that," someone bawled from a nearby raft. "What are you, heathen?"
"Nay, I'm an asshole."
For a time, it seemed the Sempus itself thundered with laughter. But the mood turned when one fool stumbled into the river. Nayor actually saw it happen. The man hit the water face first, and thanks to his armor, simply continued dropping until obscured by the reflections of his horrified comrades. Jeers and catcalls thundered from the southern shore. Proyas cursed and soundly upbraided all those floating within earshot. Afterward, the prince left Kellis and jostled his way to Nayor on the prow, his eyes shining in that peculiar way, the way they always shone after he spoke with Kellis. The way, in fact, everyone's eyes shone, as though they had just awakened from a nightmare and found their families intact. But there was more to his manner, a too-forward camaraderie that spoke of dread. "You avoid Kellis like the plague, you know that." Nayor snorted. Proyas watched him, his smile fading. "Such things are difficult," he said. His eyes darted from Nayor to the heathen streaming and massing along the southern shore.
"What things are difficult?" Nayor asked.
Proyas grimaced, scratched the back of his head. "Kellis told me."
"Told you what?"
"About Serwe." Nayor nodded, spat into the water rolling beneath the prow. Of course the Dunyane had told him. What better way to explain their estrangement? What better way to explain the estrangement between any man? A woman. Serwe. His prize. His proof. The perfect explanation. Simple, plausible, certain to discourage further questions. The Dunyane explanation. A moment of silence passed, awkward with misgivings and small misapprehensions. "Tell me, Nayor," Proyas finally said. "What do the Skilvendi believe? What are their laws?"
"What do I believe?"
"Yes, of course."
"I believe your ancestors killed my god. I believe your race bears the blood guilt of that crime."
His voice didn't quaver. His expression didn't break. But as always, he could hear the infernal chorus. "So you worship vengeance?"
"I worship vengeance."
"And that's why the Skilvendi call themselves the people of war."
"Yes. To war is to avenge."
"The proper answer. So why the throng of questions?" "To take back what has been taken," Proyas said, his eyes at once troubled and bright. "Like our holy war for Shaima."
"No,"
Nayor replied.
"To murder the taker."
Proyas shot him an alarmed look, then glanced away. With an air of admission that Nayor found effeminate, he said, "I like you much better, Skilvendi, when I forget who you are." But Nayor had turned away, searching the southern banks for sight of more men who would kill him if they could. What Proyas remembered or forgot mattered nothing to him. He was what he was.
"I am of the people."
In a long drifting column, the Inrithi flotilla entered the first of the Delta channels. Nayor couldn't help but wonder what Scaurus would think when his watchers reported they'd lost sight of the Holy War. Had he anticipated this, or had he simply feared it? Even now, the Emperor's warships would be taking positions along the southernmost navigable channels. The Sapatasha would know soon enough where the Holy War intended to land. As it happened, they were harassed only by mosquitoes. The morning, then the afternoon, took on the strange character of lulls before imminent battle. It was always the same. For some reason, the air would become leaden, the moments would drop like stones, and a restless boredom unlike any other would weigh and weigh, making necks stiff and heads ache. Every man, no matter how terrified on the morn, would find himself yearning for the battle, as though the violence of its promise burdened far more than the violence of its consummation. Night passed in discomfort and the delirium of almost sleep. They reached the salt marshes around noon the following day, a deep green sea of reeds reaching to either horizon. Suddenly the torpor lifted, and Naor felt a sudden frenzy akin to that of the charge. He waded with the others through the morass, dragging the barge as far forward as possible, hacking with his sword at the towering papyrus. Soon he found himself one of thousands stamping forward, leveling the reeds into a vast swampy plain. Eventually, inroads were cut to the hard ground of the south bank. With Proyas, Kellis, Ingaiaban, and a party of knights, Naor slogged forward to see what awaited them. As always, the Dunyane's presence made his heart itch, like the threat of a blow from unseen quarters. To the east, they glimpsed the distant breakers of the Menenor. Before them, to the south, the land climbed in stony heaps, becoming a mass of iron-colored hills. To the west, they saw a broad swath of pasture, creased like a brooding man's forehead, darkened by distant orchards. On a lone hill, barely distinguishable for the haze, they could see the squat ramparts of Anwurat. Small bands of horsemen trotted across the intervening distance, but nothing more. Scaurus had yielded the south bank, as Naor had predicted. Proyas fairly howled in celebration.
"What fools!" Ingaiaban cried. "What fools!"
Ignoring the torrent of acclamation, Naor glanced at Kellis, wasn't surprised to see him watching, studying. Naor spat and looked away, knowing full well what the Dunyane had seen. It was too easy. The Holy War spent the entire afternoon stumping out from the swamp. Most pitched their tents in the failing light of dusk. Naor heard the Enrithi sing, scoffed, as he always scoffed. He watched them kneel in prayer, congregate around their priests and idols. He listened to them laugh and cavort, and he wondered that their merriment could sound genuine rather than forced, as it should on the eve before battle. War for them wasn't holy. War for them was a means, not an end, a track to their destination, Shima. But the darkness snuffed their celebratory mood. To the south and to the west, the entire horizon twinkled with lights, like embers kicked across folds of blue wool. Campfires, innumerable thousands of them, tended by the leather-hearted warriors of Kian. The beat of drums rolled down the hillsides. At the Council of Great and Lesser Names, the Men of the Tusk, dazzled by the bloodless success of their landing, acclaimed Naor their King of Tribes, what they called their Battle Master. Followed by his generals and lesser officers, Ikuri Confis stormed from the council in a fury. Naor wordlessly accepted, too conflicted to feel either pride or embarrassment. Slaves were given the task of stitching his own battlefield standard, something the Enrithi held sacred. Afterward, Naor found Proyas standing alone in the darkness, staring at the countless heathen fires.
"So many," the prince said softly. "Eh, Battlemaster?"
Proyas hitched his lips into a smile, but Naor could see him wring his hands in the moonlight. The barbarian was struck by how young the man looked, how frail. For the first time, it seemed, Naor understood the catastrophic dimensions of what would soon happen, nations, faiths, and races. Where did this young man, this boy, belong in all of this? How would he fare?
"He could be my son." "I shall overcome them," Naor said.
But afterward, as he walked toward his solitary camp on the windy shores of the Menenor, he fumed over these words. Who was he to give assurances to an Enrithi prince? What did it matter to him who died and who lived? What did it matter so long as he was party to the killing?
"I am of the people."
Nayur Urs Sciotha, the most violent of all men. Later that night, he squatted before the churning surf and washed his broadsword in the sea, thinking of how he'd once crouched on the misty shores of the faraway Jorua Sea with his father, doing much the same. He listened to the thunder of distant breakers, to the hiss of water washing through sand and gravel. He looked across the Menonor's shining reaches and pondered its tracklessness, a different kind of step. What was it his father had said of the sea? Afterward, as he sat sharpening his blade for the morrow's worship, Kellis stepped soundlessly from the blackness. The wind twisted his hair into flaxen tails. Nayur grinned wolfishly. For some reason, he wasn't surprised.
What brings you here, Dunyane?
Kellis studied his face by firelight, and for the first time, Nayur didn't care.
I know you lie.
Do you think the Holy War will prevail? Kellis asked.
The great prophet, Nayur snorted. Have others come to you with that same question?
They have, Kellis replied. Nayur spat into the fire.
How fares my prize?
Serwe is well. Why do you avoid my question? Nayur sneered, turned back to his blade.
Why do you ask questions when you know the answer?
Kellis said nothing, but stood like something otherworldly against the darkness. The wind whipped smoke about him. The sea thundered and hissed.
You think something has broken within me,
Nayur continued, drawing out his whetstone to the stars.
But you are wrong. You think I have become more erratic, more unpredictable, and therefore more a threat to your mission.
He turned from his broadsword and matched the Dunyane's bottomless gaze.
But you are wrong.
Kellis nodded, and Nayur cared not at all. When this battle comes, the Dunyane said, you must instruct me. You must teach me war.
I would sooner cut my throat.
A gust assailed his fire, blowing sparks over the strand. It felt good, like a woman's fingers through his hair. I'll give you Serwe, Kellis said. The sword fell with a clang to Nayur's feet. For an instant, it seemed he gagged on ice.
Why?
He spat contemptuously.
Would I want your pregnant whore?
She's your prize, Kellis said. She bears your child. Why did he long for her so? She was a vain, shallow-witted waif, nothing more. Nayur had seen the way Kellis used her, the way he dressed her. He'd heard the words he bid her speak. No tool was too small for a Dunyane, no word too plain, no blink too brief. He'd utilized the chisel of her beauty, the hammer of her peach. Nayur had seen this, so how could he contemplate?
All I have is war.
The Menonor crashed and surged across the beaches. The wind smelled of brine. Nayur stared at the Dunyane for what seemed a thousand heartbeats. Then, at last, he nodded, even though he knew he relinquished the last remnant of his hold on the abomination. After this, he would have nothing but the word of a Dunyane. He would have nothing. But when he closed his eyes, he saw her, felt her soft and supple, crushed beneath his frame. She was his prize, his proof. Tomorrow, after worship, he would take what compensation he could.